You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Hello. Bear with me while I just adjust this a little bit. I'm taller than in my picture, obviously. Good afternoon. It's nice to see that you're sitting comfortably because it's story time. I'm going to tell you a story. And the story encompasses the writing of this book because a bit like with Nail and I wrote a book by mistake. This book is a mistake. I've written many books, but I didn't intend to write this one. So I'm going to tell you the story of how I came to write this book. And along the way, I'm going to talk about my kids, which I'm sure for many of you is a joyful thing. So I'm going to enjoy that. But it starts really with me becoming a parent. And for those of you who have children, and perhaps for those of you that have them in the future, you will almost certainly remember the moment when you found out that you were going to be a parent. And hopefully, for those of you who've had that experience, it was a joyful one and not an oh shit moment. But for me, it was a bit of both, because it was slightly unexpected, but it was also rendered very weird because of the place that I was when I got the phone call from my wife. So before founding Black Mountains College in Wales, I had a career as a writer and as a journalist, and I was working in the Horn of Africa in Kenya, on the border between Kenya and Somalia, in a refugee camp called Dadaab, which was at that time was the world's biggest. And I got the phone call from my wife, and she gave me the good news, and I'm looking out at a city which, for those of you that don't know about Dadaab, is about the size of Bristol. It's 500,000 people living in the desert in tents and shacks made of plastic and tin. And I'm thinking, great, I'm happy, but also, oh shit, because, you know, look at the world that my daughter's coming into. And this was at a time when I was just beginning to understand and think about climate change. But also, of course, the raw inequality of that place, and, you know, the difficulty of our global situation. And then over the course of the pregnancy, I was going back and forth reporting on the camp and refugee crises and other human rights violations in Africa, sometimes quite violent, while at the same time experiencing pregnancy and then the early life of my daughter in wonderful green, wet, cold Wales. And the disconnect and the juxtaposition was very harsh. And I, as a writer, I have a little, as you can see, I've got my journal. I write regularly. That's how I process my feelings and my thoughts. And I started writing in my notebooks when I found out that I was going to be a parent. And I couldn't really find the right register for the things I was worried about. And for those of you who've tried writing, it's often a question of trial and error until you find the right tone, the right way in which to talk about something. And the tone that felt appropriate, the right register that felt appropriate for me, was writing to my daughter. At that point, unknown being, but then increasingly we came to find out the sex and so on, but writing to my unborn daughter and then writing to her as she grew up, and then to both of them as she was accompanied by another sister. So my notebook filled up with these anxious letters of an anxious parent who at that time, 2012, 2013, I was just coming to find out and learn about the climate crisis, because at that time, particularly from the lens of Africa where I was working, this was presented mostly as a kind of regional conflict issue. So people were starting to talk about displacement in Somalia and South Sudan and the resource conflicts in Ethiopia that I was writing about as climate-driven conflict. This was a phrase that was kind of newly minted at the time. And I thought, okay, well, what does that mean? And I could see the effects of that in the camp. I could see, of course, all of the people being displaced and the floods that also followed the drought in Somalia. And then looking back at Wales and the UK and coming back on my downtime back into the UK and asking, where is the conversation in the UK? And the answer was nowhere. Absolutely nowhere. And I felt like a kind of visitor from a foreign planet walking around trying to find out what people were thinking, what people were saying, where was the government urgency at that time. So increasingly that feeling of being isolated, being on my own, that kind of disconnect then also manifested itself in these letters to my children. So fast forward 4 years, my daughter is speaking, and instead of me writing to this initially blob and then small person who can't respond, and I don't actually know what she's thinking, finally she can start to speak. And the first bit I'm going to read to you from my book, from this book, is a question that she asked, which was the beginning then of the journey to writing this book and turning it into something that could be shared and might be relevant or useful potentially for other people. And it's the beginning of a crisis for me as a parent, because it completely upended what I thought parenting was. So I've got two young children playing in the garden, and the youngest is two, calling for my attention. She's called Sissy. The oldest is called Daphne. Sissy was calling for my attention. Daddy, daddy. But I was lost in a reverie. Daphne said, Daddy's having problems with his thoughts. She was exactly right. It would not be an exaggeration to say that I am finding parenting debilitating, depressing, an affliction even. There's too much information for my brain to process and make sense of. I can't hold the whole equation together. I read recently that parents of young children are the most likely to discount evidence of climate change or to deny that it's happening, and I can completely see why. I spend each day full up, unable to tell you all that I want to tell you, to make you understand, to ask for forgiveness and to warn you for what you must prepare for. You're only 2 and 4, perfect creatures of innocence, wonder, and compassion. And of course, a child's questions are always difficult. Daphne, you've been asking things like, who put the stars there? Why does the sun go down? Where do chicken nuggets come from? But never before have a child's innocent questions become existential. The other day you asked about the seasons. It's autumn now, but the leaves are still on the trees and the temperature is still like high summer. I explained the succession, spring, summer, autumn. And when will it be winter, you asked? The most natural question in the world for a 4-year-old to ask. Yet I was broken by it and completely flummoxed. I didn't know what to say. Well, normally, what should I have replied? You think that the world is immutable, a system with its own laws and realities, and that you're finding your place within it. But our ecological reality makes this a fiction, and it makes me angry that I'm forced to be complicit in the fiction, a bit like Santa Claus or someone who's signed the Official Secrets Act, because I can't be completely honest with you. I raise you and I answer your questions on the assumption of permanence, even as I know that the swallows on the mobile above your bed may be the only swallows you'll ever see, or that the whale on your duvet cover most likely has a stomach knotted with plastic. I'm not just a prisoner of time and circumstance, but I'm also robbed of language to describe it. The names of things give me pause. The sea is no longer the sea. The sky is no longer the sky. They are chemically different. The balance of atoms in them is different from when I grew up and from the natural phenomena they once were for the people that named them so. All of this is overwhelming. Please forgive me for staring at the sky. I'm finding that the challenge of this contradiction forces us to consider what we think parenting is at this point in history, and I don't know what to do. Historically, parenting was always about reproduction, not just of life, but of ways of life. We've always passed knowledge and traditions from one generation to another, the seasons, the sources of food, water, and shelter, and the songs and customs that go along with those traditions. Childhood is framed as education, as growing up into a set of moral and ethical values about how to live well and how to tell right from wrong. The adults are supposed to know the social and moral codes, and it's the children's role to learn them. But climate change and biodiversity loss completely torpedo this assumption. The changes that are unfolding are not just about how the world is now, but about its trajectory, and therefore our expectations, and crucially, our imagination of what we think a life consists of. So that moment when Daphne was four was really the beginning of a reckoning for me of what I thought parenting was about. Because, as I said, I'm not the teacher, I'm not the font of moral and ethical wisdom here. She's the one increasingly asking questions that I can't answer. So, shortly 6 months later, there's another encounter, which I'll briefly describe, which is, she asked a similar question. It's a heat wave in February, and I think it's 22 degrees in our garden, and in her nursery, all the daffodils are popping up in the garden, but it'll still be another couple of months before she makes daffodils out of tissue paper and brings them home for Easter. All the seasons are out of whack again. And she says, "Dad, when will it be spring?" And this time, instead of keeping my mouth shut, I decide to open it, despite the risks, with my wife's voice ringing in my ears saying, "Don't scare the kids." But I feel I have to. I feel like I don't have a choice. I've already avoided the question once. I feel like I have to answer it this time. And on the one hand, I'm thinking, I don't want to scare the kids. But on the other, I'm a journalist, I'm a parent, I want to tell the truth. This is, you know, the codes I live by. So I take the plunge and I say, well, once upon a time, spring, summer, autumn, winter, but now the seasons are getting messed up. And like you've seen, it can be very hot in winter and spring, and it can be very cold. We had hailstones in summer, and we had snow, in fact, in May. And she looks at me, and I'm thinking, Christ, what's she going to say now? And she looks at me and she says, "I know." And I think, what do you mean you know? And of course, she doesn't know about the science, but she has a visceral embodied experience of the seasons being messed up in the way that I describe. It's part of her reality. And this is another big light bulb moment for me, because while I'm having to get used to a climate that I grew up in, and now aged 40, I'm having to accept that it's changed, and that all those hopes of progress and so on and things that I grew up with and took for granted are at risk. For her, this is her reality. She's grown up in this reality, and for her, it's familiar. It's part of the atmosphere in a very literal sense. So that was another big leap forward in the way that I thought about parenting. So it's not necessarily an imbalanced relationship between, you know, me passing all the knowledge and perspective on to her. Actually, this is a dialogue between worldviews. There's the worldview of those of us who grew up with the assumptions of the 20th century, and there's the worldview for those who are growing up in the reality of the 21st century. And we've got as much to learn from each other the kids and the parents, vice versa. So that then formed a shift in how my wife and I approached parenting at this time, which was a dialogue. How does it look from where you're sitting? And that, I think, is the single biggest change that has yielded insights and a kind of shift in the way that we talk about it in our family. So quite soon after that, another year or so, there was another brilliant question from my daughter, along with an awful lot of really difficult ones, actually, that I've some of which are in the book, that I couldn't answer. But one really fantastic question that yielded many others was, we were at Christmas with my father, and they were talking about how much they loved ice skating on the ice rink in Cardiff, which, if you've ever been, is fantastic and overwhelming at the same time. And they were talking about how much they loved ice skating, and Grandpa said, yeah, I used to love ice skating. And he showed us his ice skates, and they said, what, why have you got your own ice skates? Did you used to go to the ice rink all the time? He said, I've never been to an ice rink in my life. I used to skate on the lakes in Essex in the 1950s. And they couldn't get their head around this. What, you mean the lakes were frozen thick enough that you could ice skate on them? And he said, yes, that was normal. And the question that followed was, what was the climate like when you were young, Grandpa? And that was just fantastic, because he then was able to say, well, it was like this, and these were the birds I saw, and this was the temperature, and this was where we went on holiday, and these were my memories of the early mornings and the evenings. And then from my perspective, growing up in the 70s and 80s, and this is how it looked to me, and this is how the climate was when I was young. And all of a sudden, my life, but not just mine, my father's life, appeared in a different perspective, that actually this climate change is not something that's happening either now or in the future, but this is something that's been going on since World War One, if not slightly before. And all of us who are alive at the moment have lived through a process of a changing climate. It's just that some of those impacts are more noticeable now, but they were already there in the early 1900s as well. And in one of my other books, The Tree Line, I interviewed Indigenous people in Canada who remember the sky thick with birds in the 1920s, for example, species which are now threatened with extinction. So this is a very long process, and all of our lives are lived within its shadow. And what that does, crucially, is it puts us all in the same boat. So Grandpa is living his life under climate change. So am I, so are they. And our job is not to blame one generation or another. Our job is to come together and to have solidarity, to share our perspectives on this terrible thing that is unfolding, and to see what we can do together. And that has then been the thing that has really shifted how we talk about it in our family, together with this assumption that nobody's got all the answers, nobody's right. And that is one of the biggest barriers that I've found to parents being open to talking about this with kids, is that parents often feel, well, I don't know anything about it. How can I answer their questions? And the answer is, nobody's an expert. We're all victims of this, and we all can ask the same questions, and we can research this together. So the questions get sharper and sharper as these girls get older. And one of them, which I really did fail to answer, was when we went to the Natural History Museum and we looked at some of the the dodo, for example, you might know, and other species that are at risk of extinction or are extinct. And my then 6-year-old, the youngest, said very quietly, Dad, is it our fault? And that's a real humdinger of a question, because on the one hand, yes, on the one hand, not our fault. Some people, but not all people. Maybe European people, but not Indigenous people in certain parts of the world. It's a really tricky question. I couldn't answer that one in any easy way. But another one I'm going to share with you is, when the forest just at the edge of our garden, just down the road from our village, was cut down. All the time during COVID, we used to lockdown. We would go there. We would play in the forest. We would name all the animals. We had different names for the different places in the woods. After COVID, after lockdown, the restrictions were lifted, the bulldozers came up the road, and the whole forest was leveled. And we went out to have a look, and for the first time in their lives, they could see the Brecon Beacons, where we live, beyond the forest, which had never been visible before. And the whole of that area was running with soil that looked like blood. It was red. And the kids were crying, saying, "Well, why is this allowed?" And I tried to explain, you know, it belongs to the farmer. It's not ours. It's private property. And they said, "Well, but what about the trees?" I said, "Well, you know, there are other trees." And they said, but what if they cut those down? Where does it stop?" And I said, "Well, I had to say, well, yeah, good point. You know, if they all go, then we're probably in trouble." And they said, "Well, and what about the ladybird?" And I said, "What do you mean, the ladybird?" I said, "Well, what if the mummy ladybird flew away and then the tree was cut down and she came back to her nest and the babies were gone, and or the other way around, and they couldn't find their mum?" I said, yeah, good point. The ladybird might be in trouble in that circumstance. And I got really angry about that. I got really angry about that question. And I realized what was happening was, I wasn't the parent teaching them the moral codes. They're the ones with the innate moral and ethical position. And I'm the one sitting there trying to rationalize neoliberal capitalism. And they're not buying it. Fair enough. You know, they're not buying it. I'm trying to explain. And they're like, yeah, Dad, bullshit. And that, again, was another turning point where I, at that point, thought, right, we're really screwed. If we can't, you know, if we can't look our kids in the eye in this situation. So I pitched a book to Penguin. I said, we need to have a textbook for how to talk to kids about climate change, because, you know, I'm really struggling and I'm sure some other people are struggling too. And I was also looking into some of the research around climate denial being very high among young parents, the fact that people generally wanted to avoid this topic, and some really interesting research from a fantastic psychologist called Caroline Hickman, which was that she did a huge survey that was published in The Lancet, got quite a lot of media coverage, you might have seen it, about, you know, what was the real harm in intergenerational conversations about climate. And it wasn't that, you know, the young people were anxious about climate change. The thing that was driving the anxiety was the fact that adults were doing nothing, and that governments were gaslighting them, and that they could see that nobody was serious about taking action. And kids were avoiding raising the issues of climate change because they didn't want to blame their parents. And parents are keeping quiet because they don't want to scare the kids. So we've got this terrible blind spot where nobody's talking about this thing that actually we should be uniting around because, again, of this perceived intergenerational issue. So I pitched this book, and I spoke to Caroline Hickman a lot, who helped me kind of make sense of my own parenting. And some of her research was really informative. She did a series of conversations with young people in secondary school who said, "We don't want lessons on Oxbow Lakes." Who's done Oxbow Lakes in geography? I mean, they're interesting, right? But what those kids wanted to learn about was how to grow food. They wanted to know electrical engineering. They wanted to know how to retrofit their homes. They wanted to know how to organize to hold our mostly useless politicians to account. And that research I found very inspiring. And that's part of what also inspired the background for setting up Black Mountains College. So a crisis in parenting, along with this very interesting research, pitching a book to Penguin, and then part of that was then, you know, talking to the kids more about, you know, what we can do, and their experiences. And after about a year of trying to write this book and really failing, Penguin come back to me and say, you know, it's really not working. It sounds way too worthy and hectoring. You can't tell people how to parent. So we really need to rewrite this thing. And at the same time, I was having a chat with the girls, and they were coming up with all sorts of ideas of, you know, things we can do. One of which was, we can all wear woolen clothes and we can bicycle to school instead of taking the bus. And they refused to get in our diesel car. We've got one electric car, one diesel car. They started boycotting the diesel car. And so I sat them down. I said, right, this is great, you know, awesome. And, you know, what about stopping eating meat, because they're really big fans of chicken nuggets. And we had this rich, quite rich conversation. And in fact, I'm going to slightly change the order. I'm going to read you a little anecdote about meat first, and then I'm going to come to the punchline about Penguin. So an 8-year-old birthday party. This is me as a journalist on the fly on the wall of an 8-year-old birthday party. There are 6 girls around our kitchen table. 4 are eating sausages made from pork. 2 are eating vegetarian ones. I tried those sausages. They're horrible. That's your opinion. Don't yuck my yum. If you haven't heard that phrase, bank it. It may seem strange, but I think sooner or later we may all have to become vegetarian. Why? Because of caring for the animals and because of climate change. It's fine if they've had a good life, although not if they've come from chicken farms, obviously. Climate change is caused by fossil fuels, not animals. Yes, but there are lots of chicken farms. Humans are the worst species. They should be ashamed of themselves. You went on holiday in an aeroplane. So? Yes, but you have a diesel car. My parents have an electric car. You go on too many holidays. It's okay because I don't eat meat, and that's the worst. If you eat meat, you're destroying the planet. You're shaming me. Your carbon footprint doesn't make any difference at all. And that's the point where I really wanted to jump off the wall and intervene and say, stop! You shouldn't be arguing about this. For those of you that don't know, the concept of a carbon footprint was introduced by BP back in 2001, precisely to divide people so that it becomes a personal issue, not something that we organise against fossil fuel companies for. And here we are at an 8-year-old's birthday party having a fight about who's eating vegan sausages and whose parents drive what kind of car. So it's a disaster to have the conversation on that territory. We should be pulling them together. So along with that, we're having lots of other conversations with my daughters about what we can do. And one of the things Daphne said is we should get the Welsh government to enact green policies, and then we should show the rest of the world what can be done. And I said, well, you're onto a good thing here, because the Welsh government has enacted something called the Future Generations Act, and they are very much trying to be a leader of sustainability in the UK and Europe. She thought, oh, that was great. And then, what else can we do? He said, I know, Dad, you're a writer. You could write a book, and it would go viral. And I had to explain, well, generally books don't go viral, but definitely no book written by me is going to go viral. But, you know, you're onto a good thing. We could try. And so at this time, I went back to Penguin and I said, well, you know, this book isn't working. But the book, along with these sort of rather portentous lectures to parents, also had these little vignettes from these conversations from my daughters, from my letters that I very much wanted to keep secret and personal. And the editor said, oh, those are really good. Your daughters are really, you know, we love their voice. Can we have a bit more of that, please? And at that point, I hadn't shared the letters with my daughters. The idea was maybe I'll share them at some point in the future when they're old enough. But when is old enough? And I was also a little bit wary. My wife was a bit wary as well. Mostly, if you've seen any of my other books, I'm a journalist, a non-fiction writer of reportage, Africa, climate change, refugees. These are the kinds of things I write about at a distance, and I go to quite some lengths to avoid putting myself into the narrative. So this is very uncomfortable territory. But in the end, I said, well, actually, there are 10 years of letters, at which point my editor said, well, why the fuck didn't you say so? Excuse me. And so we unearthed them and edited them and filled them out a bit for publication. And hence, there is a book called Think Like a Forest, which is 10 years of these letters to my kids. And the thinking is, the sort of purpose of sharing the letters is very much like that original idea of a kind of handbook for parents about how to talk to kids. But rather than saying this is how you should do it, it's just an account of my experience. So the first letter in this book is actually addressed to you. It's called A Letter to the Reader, and I'm just going to read a little bit from that. Dear Reader, the letters in this book, apart from this one, are not addressed to you, but I'm sharing them in the hope that they speak to everyone who must live through and make sense of the extraordinary changes unfolding on our planet. And that, in a nutshell, is what this book is attempting to do. So although it's letters to my children, it's not only for them, it's not only for parents, it's also for anybody who has to make sense of the changes that are unfolding at this time. Because not only was, you know, I started off writing about refugees and conflict displacement and so on in Africa 10, 15 years ago, but since then have written other books about climate change, about the advancing tree line in the Arctic, and the new one coming out next year about the Gulf Stream. And as a journalist, it's a kind of synthesis of what we know. That's what I write about in these other books, but also here. I have the privilege as a journalist of not having to hedge my bets like a scientist and say, well, I know this much about this huge thing and I couldn't possibly comment on the larger implications of my research. But as a journalist, I'm able to say, well, I've read 200 papers on the Gulf Stream and I can say there's a pretty good likelihood that it's going to collapse within this time frame based on the average of all the studies. And that's what this means in plain language. So part of those other books, but also part of this book, is also a bit around science communication, climate communication, you know, a real sort of handy summary of where we're at and potentially why we got there. So that was the purpose of putting it together and just writing from a personal perspective, but also because my kids are pretty funny, and I know most parents think their kids are pretty funny, but hopefully you'll enjoy some of those comments as well. I'd like to give the last word to them, and then I'd like to take some questions from the audience and allow for a good amount of debate. So Penguin, having said yes, those are much better than anything you wrote before, so yes, please, let's publish them into a book. I said, we had this conversation with my wife, and we thought, well, we'll write the book, we'll put the letters out there, but, you know, maybe we'll keep them from reading the book until they are old enough. Of course, it didn't really work out like that. So this is September 2025, the last chapter. What are you writing about now, Dad? The cat is out of the bag. You've noticed my absence in the mornings when I slink off to the shed at the bottom of the garden. I've been editing my letters to you for publication. There's still things about the future that are difficult to hear, and so we still intend that you might read them when you're older. But as ever, the best laid plans. What are you writing about now, Dad? Said Daphne. a book about talking to children about climate change, I replied. Which children? Mine? You mean us? Yes, I conceded. Are we in it? Yes. Oh, can we read it? No, not yet. It's for you to read when you're 18. 9 years, said Sissy. We've got money, we can just buy it. What's the story? Daphne asked. It's about talking to you about climate change and why that's hard, I try and explain. Sounds boring, said Sissy. It's not hard, you just talk, Daphne said. You do it all the time. Yes, I know, but lots of people don't. Why not? That's weird, said Daphne. It's part of life, you can't avoid it. No offence, said Sissy, but I'd rather read The Hunger Games. And I think the fact that they'd rather read The Hunger Games, or perhaps just that they've gotten so much from The Hunger Games, is because of that first point, which is that they are living this reality, and The Hunger Games touches on an awful lot of implicit truths about where we are, about how we are effectively treating children, about the resource extraction to support the elites in the Capitol. There is something very telling about that model that I think they recognize, and which is why that's their go-to for an emotional experience that mirrors where we're at. So I think they'll... I'm worried about them, as all parents worry about their kids, but I think if they've got that grasp of, you know, our current political analysis, I think they'll probably be fine. So I'm going to stop there, and I'm going to invite some questions. Thank you for listening. I'm going to look for hands, and then there's a gentleman just on the edge there with the glasses. And then we'll come to you. And then we'll come to you, yep.
Thank you so much for that talk. That was absolutely fascinating. You mentioned about the research about children being resistant about talking to their parents because of the aspect of not wanting to blame them. I'm just wondering whether you had any experience as your children have got older talking to them about some of the intergenerational aspects of climate change and some of the injustices and some of the, I suppose, the responsibilities of our generation and that some are more to blame than others.
Yeah, it's a recurring theme, and it's something that I think they still definitely they go easy on us. I think there's definitely an elements where you hear them talking to each other or to their friends, and they probably understand and feel things more sharply than they let on to us, because they don't want us to see their distress, or they don't want us to see their conclusions in terms of, you know, how we live and so on. But you cannot generally rely on kids to be pretty honest and upfront about stuff. The main thing, I think, is just the total inability to practice what you preach. That's the key thing that they smell all the time is a contradiction. And there's a contradiction every time we get in the car, every time we buy chocolate, every time we meet, every time we do go on the plane sometimes because I've got family overseas and so on. So every time there's a contradiction, they're wagging their fingers and they're saying you're not doing it right. It doesn't manifest as blame, but it just shows up as, you know, parents not walking the walk. And I think that's one of the hardest things, is just being honest about those contradictions and saying, well, we could not go and see grandpa, or we could eliminate easy peelers from the house, but, you know, not the easy peelers. That's a red line, you know. So but the best thing I can say is that we have fun talking about it, and that seems to be the way forward for us. Yes, and then this man, and then that gentleman. The man in the chair behind first.
Hi. Thank you for what you shared. I've been in a similar position with my daughters. But recently that's changed. And it's no longer, the focus is no longer on ecology and climate change. It's switched to AI. And the concern of, well, AI, the impact it has on water usage, on energy usage, on, and it's almost superseded the ecology question, because it's, well, is there going to be much of a world left for us? Because AI is going to wipe it out. And they're still working on a fairly low level on this. Now it's my background, and to be honest, AI terrifies me. And I think superintelligence is a, you know, superintelligence, the planet and ecology and the issues there pale into insignificance when you come up against superintelligence and AGI. Now, I'm having to try and answer these questions both about how we look after the planet and how we do it in the face of this technology that's coming through. And I just wondered if you had any thoughts about how to begin to address those questions. Because those questions are, they're what's behind them is not just concern, it's fear. Because they are scared about what it's going to be like in 10 years' time.
I think the common theme there is the fear, and that, you know, we have to be careful, because I think, you know, my parents were worried about us and the life we would grow up in at the time. That was nuclear war in the 80s and Greenham Common and the sorts of things, campaigns my mum was involved with. And that if you go back a generation prior to that, my grandparents were worried about the actual war, the Second World War. So I think the fear on the part of parents is normal. Fear on the part of kids for their future is, you know, potentially less so. And I think that's a bit more widespread now. I would put, I mean, the subtitle to this book is Letters to My Children from a Changing Planet. And I would put AI as part of that, because the gratuitous AI use is, you know, there is a role for AI, but the problem is the gratuitous use of it and the prioritization of it as an engine of growth rather than a specific tool for use in specific circumstances. And the answer to all of that, I think, is around solidarity, social justice, and coming together and organizing. Some of the best experiences we've had that I talk about in this book is going on Extinction Rebellion marches together and feeling like we are part of something. And in some cases, there is positive outcomes from activism. 90% of the time, there isn't. That's how activism works. But being honest about, you know, the cost-benefit analysis of organizing. But I think it's about not just civic education, but political education. Like, if you care about these things, this is how you can change the terms. This is how you can change power relations in this country or in this county council or in this parish council or in this, in a United Nations system or whatever. There are lots and lots of examples. And again, that's something we teach at Black Mountains College, of how change happens and where it has worked and where it hasn't worked and what we can learn. The fear is well placed. I think we all share it. And I think the best response to the fear that my kids have ever had is me saying, yes, I'm scared too. And showing them that you understand and you feel it as well. Sorry. Well, yeah, let's go for, why don't I take two questions together, that lady and then the man in front, and then let's come to you, sir. Sorry. Thanks for being patient.
Thank you. So my children are now teenagers. And I think what they say to me a lot is that, like your daughters when they were very small, they know this stuff. They know what's happening. They can see it. And I think what's irritated them through their education is that people our age spend a lot of time telling them about these sorts of areas. And they then come back and say, firstly, they're really aware. They understand it better than we do. They see it and are less blinkered than we are. And secondly, rather than us telling them about it all the time, we should be doing things. We shouldn't be placing it on them to, you know, be acting. So when you were first talking about your book, I thought, could this be a great vehicle for us who are parents to be able to see things we're currently blinkered to? But also, what would you say to my children who say, we're educated about this stuff all the time, it's your problem to us?
If can I take two questions together? Yeah, this one.
Thanks. I've got a son who's six. You said a lot about talking to your kids about how things are now. What have you said about preparing them for the future, and how do they respond that the way we live now is not going to be how we live in the future?
Yeah.
How have they responded?
Two great questions, thank you. And I'll try and tie them together. I think the point about what your teenagers are saying is exactly supported by the research, is that, you know, we know this. We're not getting adequate information in schools. We're getting very outdated stuff around climate change. I think there was a GCSE question, if not last year, 2 years ago, list the positive benefits of climate change. So we are not serving them well in schools. They do know this stuff. I think the key point is, it's not our problem to solve and it's not their problem to solve. It's all of our problem together. It's both generations. And it's trying to build that sense of solidarity and saying, yes, what are we going to do? I think the key point there is, yes, we're blinkered, but it's not necessarily around a lack of knowledge. It's just around a resistance to accepting the fact that, as the other gentleman said, how we live now is not how we're going to be able to live in the future. And that is, you know, ever so slightly less of an issue for those of us who are older, but it's still an issue for everybody. And, from a philosophical perspective, I care about the people who come after me almost as much as I care about my own life. So ethically, that's still an issue. It's not, there isn't an intergenerational thing where, you know, we get to not care about it. We get to perhaps not experience some of the things that they will experience, but that doesn't mean we don't care about it. So building that solidarity, saying, I think also that it's also not a question of they know or we know. Nobody really knows. And that's the point about the future. It's uncertain. So all of the conversations I've had with my kids are around preparing for uncertainty. They're not about preparing for a particular scenario, because we don't know where we're going to end up. And, you know, there might be a miracle on the one hand, but on the other hand, the way in which all the tipping points interact and the way in which human systems respond are the biggest uncertainties. We've got lovely graphs from the IPCC about the impact of particular levels of emissions, but what we don't know is how governments and societies are going to respond and how all the tipping points are going to interact with that process. So what we teach at the college and what I talk to my kids about is preparing for uncertainty. So that means being realistic about the fact that accepting the assumption that you mentioned, that the way we live now is not going to be feasible or even possible quite soon. When will that be? We don't know. It might be 10 years, it might be 20 years, it might be slightly longer, but perhaps not too much longer. And then I've tried to use examples from the past. So my mother was one of the last generation who has a ration book from the end of World War II. So we talked about rationing. What was that like? How did it feel? It wasn't so bad. We talked about the experience of the refugee camp and people displaced by conflict and climate. And I've written a book about the joys and the highs and lows of living in a refugee camp. And yes, it's miserable to some extent, but there's an awful lot of joy and meaning there at the same time. And the other thing is around, you know, what constitutes a meaningful life. And it's really interesting and nice to be at a festival that has a spiritual angle to it, because I think that's often what's missing, is the fear of losing our affluence. Whereas actually what we should be afraid of is a life that doesn't have any meaning. And as long as that you can have a meaningful life, then there's still things worth living for. And that's also the experience of the extreme examples of the refugee camp. I don't think we're heading for a refugee camp. I know a festival sometimes feels like a refugee camp, but we're not heading for life in a refugee camp in the next decade necessarily. But there are a lot of lessons from that experience which show how you can live a meaningful life regardless of affluence. So it's about shedding that addiction to affluence and understanding for them that, you know, they're not going to necessarily have all of the creature comforts that we have at the moment, and that they're going to have to, that things are going to have to change. So I think the most important thing is just the acknowledgement of that assumption, that that assumption of permanence is not real. That's the most important thing from my perspective. Right, this gentleman who's been waiting patiently. No, this man on the log.
Thanks very much. You've been very eloquent in explaining to us some of the things that you've had difficulty with trying to explain to your daughter. My daughter, unfortunately, is in her 50s, so it's a different kind of problem. But so she's already made a mind up about a lot of things. One of the things I keep hearing is that business as usual is the biggest enemy of actually making the changes that we have to make. So I wonder whether you could comment about that. And I mean, if I've been on traffic recently as a steward, and it doesn't take very much to count up that we've got about 1,000 cars in the car park out here, and probably 300 or 400 in the caravan park, with probably a total value of tens of millions of pounds. So there's an awful lot of real estate if we're going to make changes, and people have got to be willing to make those changes. And that's the bit that you've already referred to. So I wonder whether you could comment a bit about that. And the other thing is that the people are experiencing cost of living changes and deciding whether they're going to feed themselves or feed their kids. That's how bad it is in some places. So your allegory about the refugee camp is very true in the UK, not just in Lebanon or somewhere. But my question really is also about how you reconcile that, because while a couple of dozen really rich billionaires that exist in this country are doing all right and probably have very little excuse to make changes. In fact, they're pressing us very hard to keep the change and keep that business as usual. How do we make that change? And what would your prescription be in your next book to try and encourage us? You know, because you can frighten us saying, right, the golf club is going to, the golf stream is going to stop in X years, but how is that going to make it better?
Some small questions there. Did everyone catch the questions around kind of systemic change and how we move in that direction? I think the key point for me is that climate justice is social justice. Climate adaptation is social justice. We as a society can weather incredible storms if we're united. And we've done it in the past multiple times, and we can do it in the future. And there's no reason why, even at extreme temperatures of 40 to 45 degrees, we can't grow enough food in controlled conditions with irrigation, polytunnels, solar power. It's what they do in the refugee camp on the equator. There's no reason why we can't look after everybody with all of the wealth that we have. These are intensely political decisions, and the way in which we move society in a fairer direction is politics, is organizing, is cultural change, conversations like this. That's why I you know, go up and down the country talking about it. It's why lots of other people do, and it's why many of you are members of churches, community organizations, NGOs, you know, even just being a member of Worldwide Fund for Nature, Christian Aid, Oxfam, all of these organizations which lobby and push for policy changes. There are a raft of policy changes. We know they're all there, they're all written, they're all actionable. The reason they're not being put into practice is because the fossil fuel lobby is better organized and better financed. That's the nub of it. It's not because you know, people aren't inclined to people will always make decisions within a regulatory framework that they inhabit. So that means they'll buy cars, but if they're big SUVs with diesel-powered SUVs are on sale, that's part of the menu. If they're not on sale, they'll express their consumer preference in a different way. So it's the regulatory framework which is the important thing, and that changes from politics and organizing. So either getting on the streets yourselves, writing to politicians, even just paying membership fees to some of these organizations that I've mentioned, Greenpeace, and others that lobby for these things. There are some great resources in here which point to some of those solutions. So there's a book by a Dutch researcher called Peter Gelderloos called The Solutions Are Already Here, with lots of lovely examples of where it's not just policy, but it's been put into practice. There's also a fantastic study by a group at the University of Leeds on equitable living within planetary boundaries, which has shown conclusively that there is enough resources on the planet for everybody to live well within planetary boundaries to address the cost of living crisis if we all have the standard of living of Costa Rica. And that is a lower middle class, you know, income in the UK, which is okay for everybody across the world in terms of resource consumption. That's perfectly possible. The barriers to it are organized fossil capital, and do not underestimate the level of money and the aggressiveness with which those people are organized. And they've now joined forces with the AI tech barons as well, and they are undermining democracy in Eastern Europe, in Europe in general, and across the world. So we have a hell of a fight on our hands, in plain terms.
You're talking about how to talk to children. I'm struggling with how to talk to adults in my church, who mostly seem to be climate change deniers. Mm. But maybe we need to talk to adults like children. Mm. I'm thinking your book could be very helpful, or do you have a better idea?
That was partly why I wrote it, because I used to work in politics, and the policy brief was always, if you're writing for the tabloids, you're writing for a 10-year-old. So the idea of writing for a 10-year-old was exactly that, so that this is hopefully, in terms of some of the plain speaking I've talked about, you know, this does discuss a little bit of the science, but mostly it talks about the response and the politics and the economics. So how did we get here was one of my daughter's questions. Why didn't they do anything? Didn't they know? You know, the answer is yes, they did know. This is why they didn't do anything. Here's the history of Exxon. You know, it's all very well documented, but if you only watch certain YouTube channels, you'll only get a certain opinion. And because the market, as we discussed earlier, because the market frames our preferences in a particular way, we are going to be predisposed to support the market that continues to deliver those preferences. We're always going to, you know, as they say in America, you know, the climate, Greta's coming for your guns, your steak, and your truck. And effectively, you know, we are asking people to, you know, to cut back on those things, but we're not asking our neighbours to do that. We want the government to put in place a system which organises things fairly. And that's a very different proposition, which, you know, actually, the cost of living and climate adaptation and climate justice all come together under the same solution. I think, can we have one more question, or do you want to call time? Okay, there's a lady there with a hand. I'm sorry if you're behind the butterfly. I haven't seen any hands over there.
Yeah, so I'm really inspired by what you've been saying. My children, much older, well, they're teenagers, and they're just scared. Having been around, can see the science, know what's coming, and almost live in hopelessness, I feel, at the moment. But I'm also involved in church and community and creation care. And the one thing that I've come across, and what I would like my question is, so many of us know the facts. We know what's going on. We know the history. And I believe that the only way this is going to change is we change heart set. So actually, it's not we've got to try and convince people because of the facts. your children have got the heart set because they're asking the questions. We need the adults or the people to ask the questions your children are asking to give the answers. Mm-hmm. Have you any insight in how you can change that, how you get to the heart set?
Mm. That's a lovely question. It's a nice place to end on. I think that's part of the reason why both this, the journey of this book and the journey of my next book have ended up in a kind of quasi-biblical place, because the answers are ultimately, you know, we're dealing in mythical questions about the fundamentals of our planet and our species, which are, you know, ultimately questions about creation as well. And in terms of how we live and how we connect and how we organize, we are also dealing with big questions around morals, morality and ethics. So, and the way, the best answer I can come to for that is from a children's perspective, they've got the innate ethics. Our job as parents is to make sure we don't corrupt them, you know, is to keep that wonder alive, keep that fire alive. Don't rationalize the shopping cart, you know, just go with it, really. And then in terms of the parents, it's my experience from politics that you, generally speaking, when you knock on the door, and I used to knock a lot of doors for the Liberal Democrats for my sins, for those of you who remember them, the people don't change their mind on the doorstep. All you can do is keep showing care and keep asking questions. And that's been the same in my experience with recalcitrant family members as well. You just keep loving, keep asking questions, keep showing up, and at some point they will ask the question themselves. And more broadly, when that wider, you know, when the temperature changes in the community, then, you know, they'll come with. When they see that things are moving in their direction. So just last example, in Talgarth, where I live in Wales, we're organising a food share, we're organising a food hub for the community, and everybody's on board, regardless of whether they voted Brexit, reform, they're climate deniers or not. And there's an awful lot of love for community-based solutions, and it's the action that's actually just pulling people in their wake. And what people think about climate change is kind of neither here nor there. So yeah, the best thing you want to do to convert people to talk about climate, to care about the planet, is not talk about climate change. Talk about food, and housing and the cost of living, and how we need to sock it to the billionaires. Okay, we'll stop there.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.